Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a health and environmental journalist covering food, health, and the environment on the Huffington Post and Alternet, as well as here on Progressive Radio. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and your total health environment. And that means the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our agriculture, the health of our climate, the health of our society, and the health of our habitat, planet Earth. The living being of which we are all connected and really that is the source and the foundation for every one of our individual lives. So every week on Connect the Dots, I connect the dots to different facets of our larger health environment that affect us. On today's show, I have a very special guest that I'm absolutely thrilled to have with us today. He's Larry Schweiger, the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation, one of the leading experts on climate change, as well as a leader in the whole environmental community. We're going to be talking about climate change, what we need to know, why we don't get it better, what we can do to take action, and give us a complete picture of the kinds of events like the recent Hurricane Sandy and others that are happening in our country and on our planet that we need to really face up to and be aware of. Larry Schweiger is also the author of Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth. He's a 2011 recipient of the Citizens for Pennsylvania's Future Visionary Award for his longstanding work in this important environmental area long before it came to greater notice, and now it needs to really become something that we all need to focus on. So it's my privilege and joy to welcome Larry Schweiger to Connect the Dots.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the opportunity.
Recently, it's a couple of weeks past now as we're talking today from Hurricane Sandy, which hit New York City from where we're recording the show today. And I think that was a big wake-up call, but maybe not a big enough wake-up call. When you're in the moment of crisis, when you're dealing with loss of power, fires, floods, homeless communities, negative health vectors, things that we've covered on previous editions of the show and which people can listen to in archives. When you're facing billion-dollar needs for rebuilding in a city and you're in that kind of crisis, you kind of have to look to those needs, and it's a time when people begin to look up and ask questions if they're standing on, safe ground to say, why is this happening? But then there's also a lot of effort needed to how do we deal with what we have on our plates now because of this horrible storm. I think you better than anyone can really give us a kind of context for why this is happening, because this could happen again here in the city. There are other different kinds of effects of the changing weather patterns that I think more people need to understand. Can you connect the dots for our listeners on that?
Yeah, I actually would thread back to Hurricane Katrina, because if you remember, Hurricane Katrina passed over Florida relatively, in terms of major storms, relatively minor storm. When it got into the Gulf of Mexico, it hit that hot water in the Gulf of Mexico. I had been tracking the Gulf temperatures that summer and recognized that those temperatures in the water itself were much, much higher than they would normally be. And so when that storm hit the Gulf, it recharged and became a Category 5, blew into a major storm with an enormous amount of moisture, enormous amount of energy, struck the coast and did very substantial damage that we're still dealing with today. And we saw a similar thing happen this past fall. The North Atlantic was 5 degrees warmer than normal. And when this storm passed over that warm water, coupled with a, rather unusual northeaster that added to the overall storm intensity, we saw a really a record-breaking storm in terms of scale and size and close to the near record on a major storm. And you know, for me, what really got my attention was the storm was already in Michigan and in Ontario, while the eye had not even reached the coastline yet. So it gives you some idea of the size of the storm. But the oceans are giving off more water. You know, 1 degree rise in temperature increases the amount of water that the ocean can give off by about 7%. And we're seeing an average of about a 4% increase in moisture coming off the ocean. So clearly, when you're putting more water into the sky, you know, when you have these kind of storms, you have a lot more opportunity to whip up a real storm event. We're seeing that in the West Coast, incidentally, right now, with the recent storms there, and also other storms in other parts of the world. The Philippines, for example, had an extraordinary storm just yesterday with a Category 5 event, very, very powerful, more concentrated but very powerful storm. You know, I think what we're going to see, based on what scientists have warned us, is that less overall numbers of hurricanes, but more highly intensive storms, and we're seeing that. We're going to see more Cat 3s and 4s and on further up to 5s, and less of the smaller hurricanes. So we're going to see a change, and we're also seeing a change in the scope of these storms. I think this most recent event, the scale of it, the size of it, was just such a large storm. Even though it was not a Cat 3 or 4 or 5 storm, it was a massive event. And at the same time, we're seeing droughts in the West. We're seeing the drying out of our landscapes. This year, for example, here we are in December, and there's a major forest fire burning. In fact, it just broke out of control. It jumped the lines on Saturday and is now burning vast areas of our national park at Rocky Mountain National Park. And this is a park that was acquired and has been a real treasure for the people of Colorado as well as for the people of the United States. And it's now burning up because the pine beetle has killed large portions, 80 to 90% of the trees in the western part of that park. And now there's a fire burning there. And we're seeing that kind of fire going on at this late season, which is another important thing to note, is that our fire season has expanded on both sides, spring and fall, by about 78 days because of the climate change. And so we have a much bigger season, so there's a lot more opportunity for forest fires and a lot more opportunity for forest fires to burn increasing acreage. The Scripps Institute has warned us about this in the past, that we have a six-fold increase in the number of acres burned by forest fires.
And that also contributes to a negative weather cycle and negative agricultural cycles if we lose trees that hold water. And what is how does that contribute to the changing weather patterns? In other words, it's not just that you have one effect, but it's also that effect then contributes to another effect, and there's a cycle that's being really thrown awry with all of this.
Well, clearly, maintaining forests is important for maintaining and allowing water to soak in. When you burn off your organic matter on the surface of the soil, there's a lot more chance of very fast runoff. So you change the way rivers flow. In fact, after the big fires in Colorado earlier this year, we saw enormous amounts of black water running off the streams from the runoff that occurred there. So you have those kind of changes. But in addition to that, the forests hold a lot of carbon. And we were hoping that our forests would become greater carbon sinks as more carbon became available. And what we're learning is, in fact, particularly we were learning from the Canadians, that their boreal forest, as they burn, as they die from bark beetles and pine beetles, they are seeing a very dramatic uptick in the amount of carbon being released from these forests. And they project that their forests are a net emitter of carbon and will be a net emitter of carbon over the next 8 of the next 10 years. So we see a dramatic shift in a forest system. Rather than storing carbon and being a good part of the solution, they are now becoming a part of the problem.
That's terrible. What about the beetles? I mean, do these changes also affect, you know, insect species and plant species such that you have suddenly an aggressive beetle group that's taking down, you know, these needed forests?
Well, beetles are the bark beetles are good examples mm-hmm. of what's going on out there. But, you know, the best insecticide we have is actually bitter cold weather. And bitter cold weather historically has regulated the beetle populations so that they did not explode out of control. Today, with the warming springs and warming falls, the bark beetles in the West are able to actually have two life cycles in a single year. And so when you get into that second life cycle, you get into an enormous number of beetles. And that is added to the overall problem of beetle damage. And so as these landscapes warm up, and it doesn't take a lot. It's surprising how a little bit of warming can have an enormous impact on beetle populations, but it's clearly happening, and it's happening throughout the West. You know, Colorado's seen a lot of damage. Western Wyoming, Utah, Montana, Idaho, you know, these areas, these states have seen significant damage, and we're seeing it elsewhere around the world. It's not just in the U.S. Canadian borels are disappearing through the death of forests from beetles. We're seeing damage in the Russian Siberian forests, which are also boreal systems.
Wow, that's incredible. You know, we humans like to think of ourselves as, you know, invulnerable, and yet here you have these major forests with trees many centuries older than any of our individual lives, and this kind of thing is happening in such a widespread way. It should be a message to us, really. At the same time, you know, we speak, people who are spiritually inclined or faith inclined speak of interconnection and interconnectivity. But I think, you know, just in the anecdotes that you've shared with us about this, we really see, you know, what global environmental interconnection really looks like. You know, I think we have to talk a bit about the unfortunate role that human beings are playing in, you know, kind of taking those, what you're describing as subtle, carefully balanced cycles and, you know, creating a sort of shift in a certain direction that has many different compound effects. And yet there's a, you know, how do we do this? I mean, some people are, for some reason, there's a horror or a denial or refusal to accept that human activity could be playing a role in this. We can talk later about what some of the entrenched attitudes are about that. But from your perspective, how are human activities playing a role?
Well, we do it first directly through the emissions of carbon by burning fossil fuels. That's been a problem for many, many years. And we're seeing it's a growing problem as China and other developing nations are really getting a hold of the carbon-based energy system that we have lived on. And, you know, when I first started in this work in 1971, we were emitting about 0.7 parts per million of carbon net each year. So the carbon dioxide levels were going up about 0.7 parts per million in the atmosphere. Today, that's about three times that amount. So we've seen a real spike in the 40-plus years that I've been in this field, and that's related to human energy consumption. It's related to the fact that we're completely reliant, on fossil fuels. And what we need to do is cut our total carbon emissions by about 50% over the next 20 years in order to keep within that 2-degree threshold. That's not to get back to 350, where a lot of people, including myself, would want us to be, but it's simply to avoid the catastrophic impacts of a 2-degree warming. You know, I feel pretty strongly that once we go over a 2-degree warming, we'll see very profound impacts on the Arctic tundra. It's already starting to happen. Profound impacts on the frozen clathrites under the oceans and other carbon sources, the thermal karst lakes in the North Country. So some very dramatic changes will occur if we go over that cliff. And so we're very close to it. Scientists warn us if we don't take bold action now that we will go over that cliff. And I you know, we're clearly headed to the cliff right now, and it's not that far away. And the time scale needed to gear up is getting ever shorter. So we're facing the clock. The clock is not our friend right now. And we need to, you know, really it needs to come down to, in my mind, it's time for a Hail Mary pass. It's time for us to realize that the standard ways of incrementally moving forward aren't working, and we need collectively to demand rapid change. We need to gather together and be a strong voice for the kind of changes that will keep us from going off the cliff.
So what is the actual temperature that would be the cliff point? What you said that, you know, another 2 degrees, where are we now, and where, what is that cliff edge?
Well,
what is it?
We're nearly 1 degrees Celsius warmer than we were before the, you know, let's say 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we're headed towards a 2 degree warming. And mm-hmm. a lot of that's already baked into what we're currently committed to.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to make a lot of changes very quickly. And that's, you know, so we're almost halfway to the cliff. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, we've got to act now in order to avoid going over that. Because once you go over that cliff, then there's all these other sources of carbon that nature will give up.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have control over nature. Once that happens, you know, when methane starts coming out of the oceans and when carbon dioxide is released in greater quantities from the tundra, when we have methane coming out of the thermal karst lakes and ponds in the North Country, it's a very dramatic shift.
And how, in terms of years or whatever, what are we looking at for how soon that could possibly occur? What is the range of time span that we're talking about for, you know, going over that cliff, potentially, from what the scientists are projecting based on the course we're on now?
Yeah, the tricky part of that is the course we're on now is actually a rapidly growing course because the developing countries are expanding their carbon usage, and we're not controlling ours fast enough,
mm-hmm.
And the Chinese are not as well. So, you know, when you look at all those models together, the chances of going over that cliff, you know, within a couple decades are very high if we don't act now and move.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to put a definite date on it. I think mm-hmm. people get wrapped around dates. I think the most mm-hmm. important thing to do is to say that we need to move right now to set in place the kind of policies in this country that will take us to a safe place.
Let me ask a question, because I often hear when in discussions of this precise question, a lot of people will say, well, they take a kind of a sort of a nihilistic, passive kind of attitude. I guess you'd say, well, what difference does it make what we do? Look what China's doing, and we can't control them. So, you know, what I'd like to hear is, A, would it make a difference if we, the United States, made a shift in terms of slowing this? And B, if we took that kind of leadership role, or it's not even a leadership role since there are others ahead of us in this, but, you know, would we be in a better position for some reason to galvanize other nations to also put a brake on it? Or is that kind of out of our hands? What's your view?
My personal view is that the United States leads, others will follow.
Mm-hmm.
We have shown that in our past when we've taken appropriate steps, others have tracked our behavior quite clearly. And I think beyond that, though, there's an opportunity. If we were to commit to a target that would actually get us a 50% reduction over the next 20 years and put the infrastructure in place to achieve that, which is doable and needs to happen right now. But if we did that, we could then begin to become a force instead of a drag on international negotiations and actually get, I think we need to ultimately get trade policies interlaced with climate policies. You need to have an accountability mechanism. The problem with Kyoto was that there was not really much of an accountability mechanism. And so result, you had very marginal performance by several signers of the Kyoto Agreement. And, of course, we sat it out. We did not participate in Kyoto, even though we were the inspiration behind Kyoto. We didn't embrace it. And so what we need to do now is get our own house in order and then work to get the world house in order. And I think the Europeans will be there. I know they will be because they have sent all sorts of signals to the U.S. To get there. I think the U.S. through NAFTA could leverage Canada to act more responsibly. The Canadians are acting terribly I'm talking about the Canadian government now, has been acting terribly to this whole issue. The current government is a far different government than the Canadians have had in the past. But nonetheless, we need to work with Canada. We need to work with other nations to come to a common set of targets that really are going to achieve the protection that our children deserve, and that we need to link those to trade policies.
You know, looking at the recent presidential campaigns and the absence of questions or dialogue about climate, you know, it kind of, in my mind, it could create in viewers and people following the elections a sort of chicken egg question. On the one hand, the politicians were clearly pandering to the average citizen's immediate economic anxiety. So if they failed to immediately provide a promise or a stopgap way to address those economic anxieties, clearly there was a sense that they would not have the mass of the American populace on board with them. And people couldn't really, you know, the if you came in from outer space or another country and just, you know, watched the coverage, one's impression would be Americans can't think one inch beyond whether they can fill their car at the pump or how they're going to get some job security and kind of restore the middle class. And I understand that as a paramount concern. And that was the primary theme. But there was no wiggle room at all to really look much further than that, except for some sort of stray sort of concocted issues that came flying in. So, you know, looking at that from afar, one could ask the question, well, is it the American public is just really inactivated, unaware, and just so economically desperate that they can only look to the most immediate solution? Or is it the politicians who are pandering to that, failing to take leadership, failing to educate, and acting as the obstacle in reinforcing that pattern? I mean, I know it's probably a little of both, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, clearly we have a problem where the incumbent power players, the coal, oil, gas, and others who are wedded to those fuels, have dominated our political system on both sides of the aisle, but particularly on the Republican side. And they have, if you look at the Republican platform, for example, this year, it looked like it was written by the American Petroleum Institute. I mean, it was quite offensive, to be honest.
Can you give some features for our listeners of what were the key things that they were proponents of that, you know, maybe people didn't hear it and see the agenda that you see there?
Well, as an example, they were suggesting that the policy was suggesting that we give the authority over our public lands to the states where those public lands were from. And that's an outrageous, you know, notion that you'd somehow transfer the state of Wyoming, you know, the public assets of Wyoming, you know, and does that include Yellowstone? Does it include all the wonderful national forests in western Wyoming? You know, and if you gave, Alaska the right to take care of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, it would be drilled in a minute. The theory behind that was just clearly to take care of the oil and coal and natural gas interests. And if you read it, it actually had the narrative that would come from an oil company. It wasn't even varnished. There was no varnish on it whatsoever. But I point that out because the oil and gas and coal interests have pumped literally billions of dollars in recent years into advertising. And it's interesting. They're not advertising to sell product. If you listen to the ads, it used to be you hear Gulf Oil, you know, telling you that they had the best gasoline in the world and buy our gasoline and we'll give you a cup of something or another, wash your windows and that sort of thing. And that's not happening anymore. It's all about manipulating people's thinking. And it's not just going on during election season. It's going on year round. This is propaganda. And it's propaganda paid for by the incumbent polluters to influence the American public. And frankly, it's been effective. It's confused a lot of people. Certainly has delayed action on climate change by at least 20, maybe 30 years, and has led us into a very dangerous place.
Wow. So, I mean, you know, in line with what you're saying right now, for example, I heard from some friends in California that suddenly I think 12 to 15,000 acres of wildlife preserve near Sacramento are suddenly going to be opened up to fracking in 10 days or 5 days from now. This just came to light, just suddenly announced, boom, we're doing this, a unilateral decision. So, you know, what you're saying is the public has been kind of inoculated by these ads from active participation. And also there's been stronger and less transparent and accountable initiatives from government, you know, to advance some of these agendas. Obviously, with Citizens United, we also have these polluters lobbying, supporting candidates, and really entering into the political process in ways that we can't so readily trace. Is that a part of this in your view?
Oh, absolutely. It you know, when you look at what their influence is, it starts with the media. It filters into the political structure. And when you look at the amount of money that a lot of these lawmakers are, you know, most of the denial, almost all of the denial lawmakers are taking large sums of money from the polluters. Mm-hmm. So you're basically buying their stupidity. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, you know, outrageous and actually silly things. Mm-hmm. And they're doing it because they want to get money from the polluters. And they, you know, when you hear your own lawmaker say these things, you have to, you know, you give them a certain level of respect and hopefully confidence and trust when they're not worthy of it because they're on the take. So in my mind, I think it needs a surge of public attention, a surge of public energy. You know, when the people lead, the leaders will follow. Mm-hmm. And America works best when America works together. I think that we need to connect, each of us need to connect our personal concern for these issues, for these threats, with others and bundle them together into a movement that will be powerful and will change the course of this issue. And if we don't do that, it will not change in Washington. Washington changed when America changes, and America needs to demand the kind of actions that we need to stop climate change. It's not just New York City or Louisiana or, you know, the fires in Colorado. It's all Americans. We're seeing enormous losses across this country. Iowa, for example, has had four, 100-year floods in 5 years. Now, there's something fundamentally wrong when you're experiencing these floods that are historic in nature, you know, one right after another, and then you have a drought like we have this year, and who knows what next year will bring? Depends on the irregularities of our weather and what kind of intensities it brings. So. You know, we're seeing, you know, some really radical weather on the planet, but it's just a mild warning compared to what we're going to see if we go over that cliff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting to get your perspective, and we'll talk about this a bit more in the second part of the show. But, you know, one of the things that tends to happen is that people are, you know, in their daily life, wherever they are, whether it's a small town, whether it's a big city, you know, everyone's naturally kind of focused on their daily life. And, you know, even if they look a little bit bigger, their community, maybe their region, their portion of the state. But, you know, even in New York, as a New York resident, I can see, you know, a huge disconnect between the upstate rural portions and downstate urban portions, no less what's going on in Pennsylvania, no less what's going on in Iowa. So if one place has a big storm and another place has a flood, another place has fires, another place has a drought, and they're not our neighbors, you know, we hear about it on the news. It's kind of a distant happening. And it's hard for the average person to go beyond their immediate concern and see all of this as being interconnected and going in the direction that you're describing. So, in the second half of our show, we're going to take a break for station identification here. I'd like to explore a little bit about how Americans can make an attitudinal shift and kind of, you know, you in your position can see the big picture. So I'd like you to share more of that, sure. And we can talk about that too. So we're taking a break now for station identification on the Progressive Radio Network. Please stay with us and come back for the second half of Connect the Dots with Larry Schweiger. Well, Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, talking to you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. In our show, we connect the dots between personal health and our total health environment. Coming back in the second half of our show, I'm here with Larry Schweiger, the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. We're talking about climate change, how to face up to reality, and what to do about it. So in our previous half hour, we were just kind of talking about the fact that these different climate impacts that show up different ways in different places are very hard for people to identify either how to connect what's going on in their area with a bigger picture or how to see how widespread these are, because they present in different ways, in different places. In the first half of the show, you were speaking of, forest fires in Colorado. We're talking about fracking of public lands in California. We're speaking of floods and droughts in Iowa, as well as the Hurricane Katrina and Sandy recently in New York City. So, if it's not kind of happening right in your region right now, you might consider this has nothing to do with you. Or if it is happening, I'm thinking about our listeners in your region, how do you connect the dots between, what expresses one way in one place and one way in another place? And also, how many Americans and how many regions of the country are really impacted by this at this point?
Well, there's a good example of what's happened in recent years in looking at the year 2011. We now have some science published on that. Dr. James Hansen looked at the Texas drought and the damages that were caused by the fires in Texas and the drought there. And incidentally, one of the endangered species, the Houston toad, was probably extirpated from nature in one of those fires right outside of Austin. So in addition to the 1,700 homes that were burnt there, this one fire that I happened to visit probably also extirpated this Houston toad, which means a lot to me, but perhaps not as much to others.
What does extirpated mean?
It's on the road to extinction. There are probably less than 12 left in the wild, mm-hmm. and there's not enough of a breeding population there. And the Houston Zoo is working on a restoration effort, so hopefully they'll be able to rescue. But it's clearly on its way to extinction if something dramatic happens. The habitats have been destroyed, they've been polluted, they've been burnt, and now they've been overheated and burned further. But we also see it all over America. We had this past year, 2012, various weather-related emergencies, climate-related emergencies in over 80% of the counties in the United States. So very dramatic kinds of things. And we're seeing the same pattern in 2011, a little different, but a same kind of pattern with megastorms. We had 43 megastorms in 2011. One day we had over 260 tornadoes, which is a new record for tornadoes. But nonetheless, we're seeing these more aggressive storms. We're seeing more severe droughts, and we're seeing the kind of changes that scientists have warned us about. Phoenix, for example, had three major dust storms in 2011, and they're probably going to see more of those. And when your whole city is enveloped in a massive dust cloud, that is a miserable experience to live through. And certainly not something that happened 10 or 20 years ago. It's a very dramatic shift, again, in the drying out of the landscapes of Arizona and its impact on dust storms.
Is that in any way connected to the Dust Bowl that was, true in the Great Depression that, drove people off of agricultural lands in the center of the country? Are we creating the potential for a new Dust Bowl? Because that really could affect the food supply.
Well, I think Ken Burns' recent series on Dust Bowl, raises that specter. The important thing for people to realize is that we have instituted soil conservation practices, and they give us some buffer against a Dust Bowl. But that buffer is limited, and as the temperatures continue to go up, as the landscapes continue to dry out, as we draw down more each and every day, the Ogallala Aquifer and these other important aquifers, we're going to see more stress on the entire agricultural system and more chance for agricultural failures and perhaps, as things get worse, to go back to a Dust Bowl type situation. And we want to avoid that. That's the kind of thing we want to avoid. America's heartland is really under increasing pressure from these drying out landscapes and from the lack of river flows and from other changes that are occurring. And we need to pay close attention to that. That is our breadbasket, and we need to be thoughtful. And, you know, when you put, for example, a tar sands pipeline right through the middle of the nation's largest and most important aquifer without any regard for its protection, that's a pretty outrageous thing to do. And to be doing that from the State Department is even more outrageous. So, I think we have a lot of things to learn, a lot of things to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. And those who have a lot of money are getting their way, and we need to stop that. Mm-hmm. We need to demand that our politicians listen to us, the voters. And the best way of doing that is by organizing, getting very active, attending the local meetings and hearings, being active when your lawmaker comes back home, when he has a town hall meeting, flood the room, stand up and demand change. You know, let's not just let the Tea Party do that sort of stuff. Let's those who care about the future for our children and for the future of this planet do the same thing and go and demand more responsible behavior by our lawmakers.
Mm. We've here in New York with the Fractivist movement, the movement against fracking in New York and the Northeast region. You know, we've had almost like a 3 to 4 year boot camp in local grassroots community organizing and media awareness campaigns and all the rest, which I've been involved with and reported on in this show extensively, as well as in my online journalism outlets. But, it really was brought home to me. We were talking about this during our break here when some friends raised an alarm that fracking is slated to begin within 10 days in a national 15,000 acres of national park area near Sacramento. And everybody was like, where do we write? What do we do? And, you know, and they were not aware of any local groups in place. And that could happen to any group at any time. It's both about individual action and playing your role, which I think, Americans, more and more people are getting activated to go to change.org or, you know, signing a petition and all. But it's also, as Larry mentions here, really about getting involved on the community level and in face, in person with others who are in person, and organizing groups, you know, and finding the wherewithal to do that and to spend your more of your time that way in this kind of, defending our environment, your community role, and there's, you know, sort of tools and skill sets and other groups that you can learn about that from, and as well as national organizations like yours, Larry, National Wildlife Federation, to whom you can turn, for help in organizing in your area and, you know, getting on top of the issues and getting the right information. So can people go, they can go to your website. NWF.org, and they can subscribe, and this will also keep information flowing your way about all the things that we've been talking about, as referenced both your region and the nation. But one of the things that you mentioned that I wanted to ask about is if 80% of the regions of the country have experienced these kinds of events in the last year, while we're thinking about what I'm paying at the pump, this has a big price tag, does it not?
It does. And we've been able somehow to put that in the back of our mind. But I find it very interesting when people start talking about the cost of clean energy. They'll say, well, the solar panels are X and a lump of coal is Y. And, you know, coal's cheaper than solar right now, so look, we're going to stay with coal. Well, the problem with that kind of thinking is it doesn't include the other side of the equation, which is the cost of not acting. And the cost of not acting is getting more expensive each and every day. You know, this recent terrible disaster that occurred here in New York and New Jersey and surrounding states has left a trail of a lot of damaged homes and properties, infrastructure, and has disrupted the local economies in a way that will probably take years to fully recover. And, you know, that has an enormous impact on this nation's ability to sustain itself. And not only that, but, you know, we're going to pick up a lot of the, when I say we, the U.S. taxpayers are going to pick up a lot of the tab, probably $100 billion before it's over, or maybe even more. And that adds to the $100 billion we picked up after Hurricane Katrina. And pretty soon you're talking about, you know, a pretty serious pot of money, and adds to the debt load of this nation, adds to the problem. And I find it really ironic that the very people that are fighting against addressing climate change are the first to stand in line asking for money when their state is hit with a big storm or a drought, and asking for, you know, for the federal government to pony up. And then they complain when they have to raise taxes to pay for all this stuff. And mm-hmm. so there's a lot of hypocrisy in all this, and I think it's time to flesh that out. I had a U.S. senator from South Dakota contact me, wanted to let his ranchers and cattlemen graze their cattle in conservation reserve lands, and wanted to know if we would sue them if they did that. And I said, no, we wouldn't, because those reserve lands were set aside for emergencies, and clearly we would not fight that. You know, but I went on to say, you know, Senator, the very policies that you're advancing are causing these kind of problems to get worse year by year, and you're going to cause your citizens to have pay a very severe price for your lack of action. And he started defending, and I just said, well, your policies are leading to a more exacerbated climate change. And if you look at the downscale models to South Dakota, you're going to see that state's going to suffer severe droughts into the future because of the changing patterns of climate. And, you know, our best scientists are warning us, and we're not listening to them. We're pretending that they're not speaking.
Mm-hmm. And also, there's this kind of sort of odd thing of, you know, we don't want government. We want to scale back government. I don't want government telling me what to do and all that. And then, you know, there was this message, you know, oh, well, the state should handle it. With what resources can, you know, a state, you know, under tremendous duress, a state, you know, maybe even a highly productive state that pays a great deal into the big pot of federal taxes, they just by so doing that, and maybe supporting other states that are not as great tax contributors but still have those two senatorial votes, you know, then they don't have that money available. So if the model is that, you know, every state does it and you secede if you don't like the federal policies, I think people need to look at who's generating the money that's
absolutely
running, and rethink, you know, some of this, you know, pioneering from the 1800s approach to democracy in a more complex society.
Well, and it goes back to this whole idea that we need to look more holistically at what we're doing here. This is not just about getting by on the next election. This is about getting by as a planet. It's about getting by as a society, as people who love our children and want to protect their future. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to reframe this whole conversation around the moral obligations. I find the one moment of reality that's sort of slipped into the presidential campaign was when Mitt Romney suggested that he wasn't going to try to hold back the oceans. And I was pleased that President Obama framed his response in a moral frame, mm-hmm. because he talked about our children. He talked mm-hmm. about the obligation we have. And I think that's what we need to take to heart. Mm-hmm. This is about our duty on our watch to take care of the world so that our kids might have a safer world. They're not going to have the same world we have. We know that already. We've left the Holocene. We're into the Anthropocene, which I call the Idiocene, because no one would want to go there if you knew what it looked like. What we're doing is we're setting this world up for our children in a way that's going to be very, very destructive. And I don't know a single parent, I don't know a single grandparent who wouldn't even forfeit their own lives to protect their children's future. Mm-hmm. And yet here we are living high on a hog and carbon heaven, destroying and creating a hell for our children. And in my mind, our politicians need to understand what they're doing and how that impacts the future. And it's not just our children. A lot of us, if we're young, are going to experience some of the most severe weather changes that we can possibly imagine.
Mm-hmm. You know, the thing is, there seems almost to be, when I hear your framing of this, like a tug of war between you know, the concern for the future generations, which Carolyn Raffensperger and others talk about as well, with, you know, this quarter's bottom line. And, you know, what we need to make what we need to. So, you know, it's like any regulation that makes it safer or that reduces something or that, you know, is, you know, that's going to cut into the bottom line. We need to invest all these infrastructure, you know, billions of dollars in infrastructure for fracking or tar sands or all these other things to enhance the bottom line. So there seems to be almost like a tug of war, you know, between our sense of duty and responsibility, and, you know, the quarterly bottom line. And how do we get beyond that if those with the most power and in that kind of leadership position are addicted to one? And, you know, one, like, how do we get past that, at A? And B, one of the things, I mean, I think I heard it was John Perkins, at a Green Festival. He said, He stood before the crowded room and he said, these people, the people who are, you know, running these large industries that are running our climate into the ground, they don't care about their grandchildren. Don't speak to them about the grandchildren. There's a disconnect there. Now, you know, undoubtedly speak to, you know, to people. Is there a disconnect? How do we bridge that?
Well, I think we lack, in some respects, imagination and particularly moral imagination when we think about our own children. We need to connect what's happening to our natural world with what's going to happen to our children. And not just, you know, save money for their college, but also take action to protect their future. I also think that we as Americans, have a hard time seeing how we can, in how we can experience the kind of radical changes that we need. My best example of that is when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon and took his first steps, my grandmother and I were watching television, and she said, you know, Larry, 66 years ago, I watched John Bashir, that was her great-grandfather, and Samuel Pierpont Langley working on the first flying machine before the Wright brothers. And she said, in that little red building up the street here. And she said, now I'm watching a man walk on the moon. Can you imagine that? She said. And I said, Graham, I can't. And the second time she said, can you imagine that? And I said, I can't. And then finally she said, for greater emphasis, can you imagine that? And that haunted me for years. But it is about imagining a world that's different. So it's seeing a beautiful future with clean energy, with efficient energy systems, with all the jobs that will be created by all that good activity. And also seeing our children having a better world for having had us as parents. And so for me, it's seeing that larger image and imagining what that might look like 10 or 20 years from now, as opposed to what it's going to look like if we fail to do anything, if we continue to sit on our couches, if we continue to fail to engage in our communities, we continue to fail to stand up for our children's future. There's a very different outcome in those two different scenarios. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's imagining that better world and demanding that others see it as well.
Mm-hmm. So when you get together and speak with some of these corporate leaders, which I'm sure you do, and when you speak to government policymakers, and you draw this kind of dramatic choice to their imagining, how do they respond? I mean, what kind of responses do you get?
Well, we've gotten, I just recently spoke to a reinsurance company here in New York, as a matter of fact, and it was interesting because their office had been flooded out by Sandy, so it was a real interesting conversation. But I think, you know, there are certain industries that are seeing it now and others that know it's happening but, you know, have not put it on their top priority. Mm-hmm. But we clearly need to get corporate leadership at the table. We need to have corporations along with citizens demanding the kind of changes. And for them, it's about having a strategic plan that has built into it a future that is a low-carbon future. And so if they have a large carbon footprint as an industry, they need to change. And we see some really great examples of that. Alcoa Aluminum, for example, has done some incredible things to move away from what was a high carbon footprint to a low-carbon footprint. They're also, you know, cleaning out their toxics and really shaping up the company in a way that's really impressive. GM, for example, has done enormous good things recently. They recycle all their products, all their waste products, In fact, an example, one of the GM executives recently told me that if I took a bag of trash out to the curb, I'm disposing more waste than the entire 102 GM plants. And that's a pretty strong statement, but it shows you what industry can do if they make up their mind to do that.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things that I sometimes hear is, in fact, I was at a town meeting. I was reporting on a town meeting in an upstate region that had been, you know, the power had been out for several days because of Hurricane Sandy. And at the very same meeting, there was a gal who was instigating a new recycling bin. Because that town had no plan for that, and you know, where people could bring, or you know, they would give out bins to people who wanted to. At the same time, so that's like, you know, the sort of message of individual action. I love the message you're talking about companies really kind of looking at the big picture. But I also get sometimes, you know, in my blogs, and because I always read blogger comments, and people write back to me on my Facebook page and let me know what they think, because I do a lot of posting of environmental and health news there, you know, and that's connecting the dots for health for anyone that's interested. But often people will write back and say, well, unless we conserve and each individual does this and that, we'll never get there because we have no leverage with these companies. And, you know, so how would you, A, contrast the role of individual action in conserving or recycling, and B, what leverage can individuals you know, put to encourage the companies that are going down the pathway you're describing versus others that are, you know, kind of flouting our needs to address climate change?
Well, I think individual actions are important, and we need to change our light bulbs. We need to do all the other things that, that come along that path. But we need to have collective action working on changing our government policies. If we don't have strong policies that really lead us in a safer place, put a price on carbon, for example, and start moving our energy system very rapidly, you know, maybe 5% a year into a safer world, we're going to lose. And so, you know, I don't want us to lose. And so I think both of those are really important. You know, we certainly have to walk our talk, but we also need to be willing to stand up and speak. And Americans, for whatever reason, the last 25 years have slipped away from community engagement. They've slipped away from activism. When I was in college, we marched on the streets for Earth Day. We demanded change. We got the Clean Air and the Clean Water Act. We got the, you know, got a number of other really important pieces of legislation passed. And I ended up working in the state legislature as a result of that. But those are the kind of actions, as people speak up and demand change, we can have a real voice in the outcome, and we can change the way this thing ends. And I believe very strongly in a democracy. It's the people that make the change, not the politicians. Mm-hmm. The politicians respond to the people, but it's the people that need to demand that change.
Mm-hmm. I think we've definitely, you know, seen an uptick in activism where it used to be, well, the people could kind of work in their private corners. I think more and more people are coming to recognize that they need to organize. I mean, this is putting you on the spot a little bit, and I won't say the name directly, but I think one of the environmental groups is asking for people to also divest holdings, you know, investment holdings in fossil fuel companies. I mean, do you think that's a fruitful direction, for
well,
example?
I will first of all say that, speaking of 350.org and Bill McKibben, Bill and I are dear friends. We were on a radio program just the other day.
Okay.
But I think what Bill's doing is fantastic. Uh-huh. And I've said it on other stations and other radio programs. But I think what we need to do is all of us, and we, NWF works with Bill, like on the pipeline. We brought thousands of people out as well and protested the State Department's actions. And
that's great.
And we're a part of all that. And, you know, Bill and his folks, you know, 1,263 people went to jail, I think it was. And so that those are really powerful actions. And we see it right now in the pipeline. You know, the local leaders are fighting that pipeline as it comes across their farms. I mean, when you have people that have been on a farm for, you know, families have been on a farm for more than 100 years, and all of a sudden a Canadian company comes in with a right of eminent domain and takes your land away from you and you then get arrested for trespassing on your own land, trying to block it. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty amazing thing that's happening, and it's really gotten the attention of a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it's fighting it out on the ground. It's also doing all the other things that we can do, email and communicate. We generated, the collective community generated over 3 million letters and emails to EPA on the carbon rules. That's 3 million Americans that took time to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think those same people need to take the other actions that are needed, including attending local hearings and meetings and letting their local lawmakers know that they're watching them. Mm-hmm. That's going to be very powerful. So it's a combination of emails and letters and civic engagement in a very powerful, meaningful way. And I think it's going to take a lot of groups all working in concert, one to another, mm-hmm. to get this done.
Yeah, actually, we're going to have to sign off now, actually. So, but I just want to add that I think it's a wonderful experience to feel empowered and to work with others. And I want to thank you for being on Connect the Dots, Larry. It's been great having you. Thank you for the work you're doing. And listeners, please go to nwf.org, sign up, get the email information, connect with others, and see you next week at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on Wednesdays for another edition of Connect the Dots. Have a great week.